the Bat Empire Bat Podcast. This Bat Week, we're joined by Denzel Washington, the star and director of the Oscar-nominated behemoth Fences. Oh yes, and Lego Batman himself, Will Arnett. That's a Bat's lineup. All that and more on the movie podcast. It was very nearly violently ill on national TV last night. True story. Hello, Pod. I'm Chris Hewitt, and welcome to the Empire Podcast in association with mustard.co.uk, the insurance comparison site that helps you save time, money, and effort. And this week, helping me save time, money, and effort as well are two colleagues of such lethal cunning. First up is a man who was very nearly finally ill at the BAFTAs. Well, of course he was. He's a classy guy. He likes to be ill, surrounded by subtitles and tuxedos. Mm-hmm. It's our art house guru, Phil DeSimlin.
Hi.
How are you, man?
Good. That sounds like the prelude to an anecdote that literally no one wants to hear. So I won't tell it. But I was actually quite violently sick at the BAFTAs.
Were you?
Or as I like to call them, the BAFTAs. Yeah.
When?
I've been working on that for the last 7 years.
When?
Colin Firth is going up to collect his BAFTA for A Single Man.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Okay, so that's, when was that, 2009, 2010?
It's a while back.
Yeah.
I've recovered.
2011, 2012?
I manfully came into work the next day until it was pointed out to me by several people that I'd actually turned yellow.
I
looked like a Simpson.
I remember this.
Because it was the whole norovirus. I was sick and then I got the flu.
I remember this. I remember I was, whatever I was doing at the BAFTAs, probably fitty bloggy sort of stuff, and I came in to see you guys because you were in the press room and you weren't there. And I remember asking,
Where is he?
Where's Phil?
He's in a cubicle.
Yeah. And he's been reduced to a small green yellow streak.
Is this the worst start to a podcast ever?
Covering the event from a cubicle.
No, this is
gastrinitis.
People need to know that
the stuff we go through.
It's not all glamour.
It's not
all glamour.
Almost none of it's glamour.
Very little glamour.
Yeah.
Mild glamour.
A lot of fun. Love
the BAFTAs, that's good.
The BAFTAs.
Good to work with that.
The other voice you're hearing, of course, is our Jurassic World star, man who's taken time off from jet setting and commanding minions to do his bidding. It is Edmund, of course, from Jurassic World.
Hello.
Nick DeSimlin, a man who was very nearly violently ill on the set of
Transformers 2, Revenge of the Fallen. I was violently ill.
Well,
I actually had
amazing.
To delay my flight by like 2 days.
Really?
Yeah, I saw the script. I didn't see the script, but I got proper sick.
Robot
balls. I could only eat like dry toast
this was
about a month afterwards. This was in, the pyramids. I got to see John Turturro climbing a pyramid.
Didn't you also get to see Paul McCartney?
I saw Paul McCartney. He was staying at, staying in the same hotel as us. It's a nice hotel.
Yeah.
Yeah. I was working on a Macatron gag for the feature, but it never made in. Probably for the best.
Yeah. Yeah. And probably went with everything else that left your system when you were violently ill.
Probably.
Who knows?
Kids, don't get sick.
Don't get sick. Try not to get sick, people.
Don't watch Transformers 2 either.
Yes. Revenge of the Colon. So we're going to...
It is the BAFTAs this weekend, so in a way that was topical.
It was topical. Well, no, it was very topical because it was in direct relation to something that happened to me last night.
Hmm.
So you can't get more topical than that.
And there's a new Transformers film coming. So this is basically the news section.
This is awesome.
Yeah,
this is good.
Stomach news.
So people are going, oh, Helen's away. Helen's away. Oh, yeah. Here come the boys. Yeah. So what are they going to be talking about? It's all right. Refined.
Football, lads banter.
It's culture. No, we're talking about being finally ill in the first 4 minutes of the podcast. Anyway, it's all good. We're going to bring it back. Here's a question. The question is via email from Amy Noble. And she asks, I was wondering what your favourite use of a cinema in a film is. One of my favourites, says Amy Noble, is True Romance. And how I'm just pronouncing words in a very weird way. I realised that I said Will Arnett.
I noticed of, that.
Yeah.
I thought that's the correct way to say it.
No,
it's
not.
Weird.
It's not.
Okay.
It's Arnett. But I didn't want to go back.
I believed you. I believed in you. I was going to change the way I say it.
We spent about 2.5 hours yesterday discussing how to pronounce Denis Villeneuve. It went from Denis Villeneuve to Dennis. Not just Dennis, but Dennis, like proper kind of Only Fools and Horses.
Okay.
Villeneuve.
What?
I know. To Denis Villeneuve.
I call him Easy D.
Easy D.
That's just the way we roll. I've never met him, but I will call him Easy D if I do.
Easy D.
I've met him and don't.
So, okay, you've... Oh, right, all right. So you've met him.
Yes.
So...
But I did that thing that I...
How were you introduced to him?
Where I normally do, where you sort of like start the word and then just sort of... So I was like, hello, Denis.
Were you introduced
to him? Let's talk about your film, Ensemble. Wow. Encenders.
Oh, yes, yes. That is one of the more difficult names to pronounce.
Encendies. Have you been corrected when you introduce someone on the podcast occasionally? Like if you say someone's name and then they kind of go, that's not
I was.
She. Yeah, who was that? Oh,
that's a good question.
Is that Colin Trevorrow?
Colin Trevorrow.
Because yep, that's a tricky one. I'm still not too confident in how you say
I still
one.
Don't know. Is it Trevorrow or Trevorrow?
It's Trevorrow.
Trevorrow.
The rule of thumb here is that you go with the way the person whose name it is yeah. pronounces it. So if Colin Trevorrow says my name is Colin Trevorrow, then it's Colin Trevorrow.
Doesn't apply to
but
what
I'm not confident in how we say our surname
different
two
ways.
Different ways.
It's Revenge of the Colin. I don't know. It's an interesting thing. I'm interviewing Denzel Washington today, and we've all been pronouncing Denzel, haven't
Denzel.
We? Denzel for years. It might be Keith.
Easy D.
For all we know. Easy D.
Easy double D.
Easy D.
Easy D.
How
double.
Much will you pay me if I introduce him on the podcast as Easy D?
Not enough to cover your medical costs.
Easy. I could whip around the room. You know, he's pushing 60, isn't he, Denzel? I could skip around him.
How do we get onto this?
Because I pronounce True Romance as Romance, and I pronounce Will Arnett as Will Arnett, or Arnett, or whatever. Anyway, I wasn't even halfway through the question. One of my favourites is True Romance, says Amy Noble, and how it is used to introduce Christian Slater's Clarence Worley to Patricia Arquette's Alabama Whitman. that genuinely was. I did pronounce Whitman. What's happening to me? Alabama Whitman.
So this is the Sonny Chiba double bill, triple bill?
Triple bill.
Triple bill. I have a friend, Ali, who has done this triple bill.
Ali.
He loves True Romance so much that he actually watched the Sonny Chiba films.
What are those films?
Oh, about... Gosh.
Yeah.
I'm going to have to text him.
Text your friend Ali right now. Text him at 0800.
Son of the Street Fighter. I can't remember, to be honest. I'm not a Sonny Chiburologist, but...
You just reminded me of... I don't know. Sorry, this is completely irrelevant, but the John Travolta... The John Travolta, Idina Menzel, the meme YouTube thing that went around where he mispronounced every single name of the Oscars, apart from Kwevenjine Wallace. Which he got spot on.
And Chiwetel Ejiofor.
And Chiwetel Ejiofor. Oh, that was genius. If you haven't seen it, Google it immediately. I don't know what you'd Google, but...
Oh, I've got
it. Right, so I've got it.
I've got it too. You say one, I'll say one.
Street Fighter.
Yes, the Street Fighter. I thought I was going to say the Street Fighter. Return of the Street Fighter and...
Sister Street Fighter.
Yeah, there we go. This is something cheaper, triple bill. That's a great scene. Any other examples, gentlemen, of...
Inglourious Basterds?
Yeah.
Chuck another Tarantino one in there. Obviously, I can think of two films with an exploding cinema, one of which is Gremlins and the other is Inglourious Basterds, both of them very, very good.
Speaking of use of cinemas, that it's a confined space that people get sort of trapped in, hence the blob, where the blob oozes in, and Inglourious Basterds and American Werewolf.
Yes.
The sense of like suddenly you're out having fun watching a movie and then suddenly you're gonna die kind of thing. Also, Donnie Darko.
Yeah.
Donnie Darko.
So cinemas and movies can be quite dangerous places, especially if Mickey Rourke is around with a popcorn bucket.
Yeah.
Which if you've seen Diner, I'm not going to describe the scene, but it's probably I'd rather go in a Gremlin-style fireball than have that happen to me.
Be near the exit.
Yeah. It's very important. Yeah,
Dan Jolin. I think that's a Dan Jolin approach, isn't it?
Yeah.
He needs to be near the facilities. That would save his life in a lot of these scenarios.
He does. I always worry about reviews written by Dan because I've been to see films with Dan and he visits the toilet about two or three times and I just wonder what he's missed.
Can't talk about this on the podcast.
I wonder what he's missed.
Yeah. His review of The Usual Suspects is...
Why is everyone banging on about this twist in The Sixth Sense? There's nothing wrong with it. It's fine. Totally fine. Yeah.
There are many examples of this and I can really only think of like a handful. But one of my favourites has to be Blazing Saddles. In which they go into cinema and watch Blazing Saddles.
Yeah.
On horseback.
That's a good one.
There's so many postmodern examples of that. And pretty much the same thing happens at the end of In the Mouth of Madness, the John Carpenter film.
Oh, yeah.
Where the world goes to shit at the end. It's part of his Apocalypse trilogy along with The Thing and Prince of Darkness. And it's really just a batshit insane ending where Sam Neill, I won't say it, but ends up watching a movie about the thing that's happening in the world right now, and he just the last scene of the movie is just him laughing insanely at the events So it just ruined the movie for everyone.
Whoa,
but anyway, yeah.
I just saw that it's recently. Really good. I just saw that recently. There's a great gif of Sam Neill just laughing, which he tweeted quite recently as a response to some political thing that was going on. There's another meta one I can think of, which is Gremlins 2, the new batch, which was, in the American version, it's John Wayne interrupts the film. Is that right?
No,
Hulk Hogan.
Okay, yeah, so Hulk Hogan, and then we got John
Barry
Wayne,
Norman.
A bad John
right.
Wayne. Hulk Hogan interrupts the movie. Leonard Maltin, the great American film critic, is reviewing Gremlins.
Yeah.
So he's part of he's in the Daniel Clamp building, and he has his own show on the Clamp Cable Network, and he's reviewing Gremlins, and the Gremlins appear, and they start attacking him, and then the film breaks down, and in the States, initially at least, Hulk Hogan popped up and had a fight with the Gremlins, and it all went weird.
Why
and
did
then,
we not get that?
And then they decided that Hulk Hogan wasn't didn't have
Hulk
a cultural
Hogan.
Currency at
he
that
totally
point.
He totally did. He totally
so
did.
John Wayne. A bad John Wayne impression shows up in the UK version instead. I think we have the Hulk Hogan one now.
Stop it, you gremlins. That was my John Wayne.
Hey, pal. I hope you washed those hands. That's a line from the movie.
Helen's not here today, is she? Obviously, she's not here because I can see. But she might not, if she listens to this. La La Land.
Yeah.
When Ryan Gosling takes Emma Stone to watch...
The toilet.
Not the toilet. To watch Rebel Without a Cause at the Rialto Cinema.
That's right.
And schools her.
Yeah.
In this marvellous film that she's literally never seen before.
Yeah.
I know that's a favourite of Helen's.
Yeah, because he mansplains.
Not.
He rebelsplains.
Yeah.
But then the film burns up. And then someone pointed out on Twitter that no wonder, because later on when we see the Rialto Cinema in La La Land, it's closed. And it's like, well, no wonder your attitude towards film preservation is just shocking.
Lax.
You're just burning up the film. It's classic print. It could be the last print of Rebel Without a Cause. You just
maybe
burned
Melanie Laurent from Inglourious Basterds was in there trying to take them down. There's another meta one I can think of, which is Last Action Hero, which doesn't... I like what it's trying to do. It doesn't do it particularly well, but it's trying to be kind of meta with the idea of a cinema. And I think originally they were going to do more stuff, like they were going to have... Arnie's character taking a scratch off the film and using it as a weapon and things like that, which would have been really fun, but they didn't do it.
It's his movie that he goes in and sees, that they're seeing.
The kid goes into Arnie's movie and then Arnie comes out at the end, right?
Yeah.
Yeah, in the real world, yeah.
Yeah, so that's kind of fun.
I love that idea that when you're in the cinema, you're sort of alone in the dark and it's a very personal relationship between you and the film, and therefore you have examples like The Purple Rose of Cairo, the Woody Allen movie, where Jeff Daniels' character is in the movie and then starts addressing Mia Farrow, who's in the audience, and then their kind of lives intertwine from there, which is quite fun and playful. If you're still with Public Enemies, the Michael Mann film, at hour 17, there's the scene where Johnny Depp's John Dillinger... It recreates the moment where John Dillinger goes to watch Manhattan Melodrama at the Biograph Theatre before he's obviously gunned down by the FBI. Before they send in the feds.
And excuse me, you're spoiling films.
Statute of limitations.
This is ridiculous. Come on.
It's 100 years ago. It would be remiss in this current climate of viral sickliness, not to mention Outbreak, in which the germs spread through a screening of What's Up, Doc, wiping out Peter Bogdanovich's entire fan base.
Wow. Really?
Yeah. Do you remember that one?
No, I don't remember.
There's a sneeze and you follow the germs. It goes germ cam.
Isn't it Patrick Dempsey or who is it? He's like patient zero, isn't he, Patrick Dempsey? But does he go to the cinema?
I do.
Because I just remember that shot of the person coughing and the close-up of the germs that we can't see spreading through the air. It's quite
pretty effective.
Talking about creeping dread and death, Mr. Bean's Holiday, that just popped into my head. Oh, my goodness. That's the only time I've ever interviewed Willem Dafoe was about Mr. Bean's Holiday. Of all the films to talk to someone about. But yeah, that he plays a kind of... Mr. Bean goes to Cannes, and Willem Dafoe plays this highbrow art house director who's premiering his new film, and Mr. Bean gets stuck in the projection booth. It's all a bit fuzzy, but that's one of the worst films I've ever seen.
And Mr. Bean replaces the reel of the film with his own home video.
And it gets a massive reception.
Yeah, and people think it's an avant-garde sleight of genius.
I went into the junket and Willem Dafoe said, please ask me about any film but this one. That was how we started the interview. That's an astonishing film. Doesn't Mr. Bean kill someone in that film?
He probably does.
So I reviewed it at the time and I used the pun natural bean killer. So I'm pretty sure he pushes someone out a window accidentally and they don't fall to their death.
He is a sociopath.
He's a human virus.
He must be stopped. He must be stopped. There's loads. There's loads. You guys haven't even mentioned...
Taxi driver,
Cinema Paradiso.
Matinee.
What else is good in terms of projection?
Well... Amelie. Mm-hmm. They go and watch Jules et Jim.
Well, Cinema Paradiso may be the best one. It's got that amazing moment where they splice together all the kisses from different movies.
It's a hot moment.
It's a touching moment.
That's what I meant.
Right.
Okay.
Okay.
And Taxi Driver, they do the same thing, but with...
What's happening?
I don't know. Taxi Driver. He takes Sybil Shepherd to watch a porno.
I wrote it down. It's the Swedish Marriage Manual.
Is that what it is?
I was googling Swedish erotica. just happened to find
that related.
Yeah, right. That's what the film and Taxi Driver is called, which is, I think, a made-up film. That's not a real. That's made up by Paul Schrader, presumably.
Yeah. So what are you saying is the definitive one, the number one? Is there anything that's better than True Romance?
anything better than True Romance?
Yeah,
I think Cinema Paradiso.
Yeah,
yeah, for me, I reckon.
Oh yeah,
I reckon. Or Blazing Saddles.
The Hall of Demons.
Right.
The Hall of Demons, which is set inside a cinema.
Is the film called The Hall of Demons?
No,
is it called the Demons? You're talking about all of it.
Demons.
Oh.
Lamberto Bava's Demons.
Oh.
You ever seen it?
No.
It's a group of people go to a cinema and they're given a weird ticket and they're mysterious. Oh, what is this? I assume this is what happens at previous screenings. Someone cuts themselves on the ticket, I think, or a mask, I can't quite remember, and starts to turn into a demon. It all goes completely nuts, and people then they try and get out of the cinema, but they find that all the exits have been blocked up and bricked up, and so suddenly they're finding themselves. Everyone starts to get infected by these crazy, drooling, multicolored, fanged, toothy terrors. You know, it's a bit like...
Sounds like this podcast.
Yeah, it is. And there's another really, really creepy scene in a movie, let alone horror film, called Messiah of Evil, which is directed by Willard Hoyt.
I saw that last year.
Really?
Because it's by the two people who wrote Temple of Doom, a husband and wife team.
Yeah.
So I watched it. That's a weird film.
Mm.
Lamberto Bava's Demons from 1985.
That's correct,
it's set in West Berlin.
There you go.
I'm in.
Yeah, Messiah of Evil. There's that really, really creepy scene where someone goes to the cinema and they're watching the film, and it's a really long, drawn-out sequence, and more zombie-like people just start creeping into the cinema, getting closer to him, sitting closer, closer, closer. Is it a woman? I can't remember. And then eventually, it's a big old fight to the death. It's very interesting. But there you go.
Lastly,
okay.
Celebrating cinema, Hugo's got a great scene with Sir Ben Kingsley as
Sir Ben.
George Méliès.
Sir George.
Sir George Méliès, Lord Méliès.
Yeah.
George. Introducing, is it Trip to the Moon?
Uh-huh.
It is.
I like that scene.
Yeah.
Voyage a la Luna.
That's
the Spanish.
Four languages.
That's the Spanish title.
Voyage.
It might be the Spanish title.
Okay. We haven't mentioned any drive-ins. Are we saying just cinemas?
Oh, yeah.
Save that maybe for another week.
Let's do that next week.
Drive-ins are...
Like cinema, or like movies in prisons, or movies in... barracks or...
Well, Shawshank Redemption has a great scene. You know, we could talk about this for ages.
What makes a cinema?
Targets. Peter Bogdanovich's Targets has a... You know, it's about a sniper who targets a drive-in movie theatre. And it's quite chilling. And you get Boris Karloff as the movie star who tries to take down this absolute whack job. It's good movie.
For another time, perhaps. Part two.
Let's definitely do movies in barracks next week.
Oh, hush your mouth. Hush your mouth.
Brothers, please, let's try to get on. If you want to have your question read out in the Empire Podcast, you can, of course, send them in via email. We're podcast@empireonline.com, or you can tweet us. We're @EmpireMagazine on the old Twitter device and use the hashtag Empire Podcast, or chances are we won't see it because we're so goddamn popular. And you can also Facebook us as well, where we are Empire magazine. Okay, we have two cracking guests this week. Let's get on with the first. He is a wonderful comedic actor whose distinctive voice gave life to Lego Batman in the Lego Movie with such success that he's back with his own Bat spin-off. It is, of course, Will Arnett, and he was talking to Emma Thrower about all kinds of lovely Bat stuff. Enjoy.
On.
Oh my goodness.
We got that.
That's live sparkling water. It's a first, I think, on the Empire podcast.
Is it?
I think it might be.
A lot of people don't know that I do all my own Foley work. So I do... Hello?
This works really well on radio.
Yeah, it does work, right?
Yeah.
I noticed that people still do, like on the BBC, they still do like the radio plays here.
Yes.
Which is hilarious to me. Because as soon as I start hearing the radio plays, I start worrying that we're going to get, you know, that I start listening for German planes. It feels like it's so archaic. I feel like I'm in World War II.
Do you feel like you need to come over here and get involved with the BBC somehow, maybe?
I feel like I need to come over here and get Neville Chamberlain out of office, for Christ's sake.
I mean...
Don't get me started on Neville Chamberlain. That guy. Ruined it for everybody.
But anyway, I suppose we should welcome you to the podcast, first of all, maybe.
Thank you, yes.
So as you can hear, Will Arnett, a man whose voice is probably going to make your day about 99% better, is here, but he's pouring sparkling water.
Yeah.
So we should probably talk about Batman, I guess.
I guess we should. I mean, let's touch on it for a minute.
Should it?
And then let's move on to stuff that's more important.
Okay, like Neville Chamberlain.
Neville Chamberlain, Call of Duty.
Mm-hmm. Yes, yeah. Always Call of Duty.
Yeah.
In the Lego Movie, you popped up and you stole the show.
I don't know about that.
And now you're carrying this film. Did you feel a different kind of pressure coming into this one?
No, not really. To be honest, I didn't really feel that kind of pressure because... The first in the Lego Movie, Phil Lord and Chris Miller, who wrote and directed that, are such brilliant guys, as you know.
Yeah.
And I'm sure all your listeners are big fans of everything that those guys do.
Definitely.
And are currently working on as well. And so I knew I was in good hands. You know, originally I knew those guys. I had recorded for a few months Cloudy with a Chance of Meatballs.
Yeah.
Ahead of Bill Hader, and it was a much darker vision for that film. And Sony, upon kind of watching early stuff on it, thought it was going to be too dark for... They wanted it to be a much lighter, kind of bigger family event film. They didn't want to take a chance on doing something that was too different in that way. Sure. And I can't blame them. So we kind of parted ways, and it was very sad. They were so bummed, and I was so bummed that it didn't work out. Especially after we had such a great start to our relationship.
Yeah.
And they knew I was a massive Withnail fan. And they got me a vinyl copy of the Withnail soundtrack.
Amazing.
Which they must have gone to great pains to locate, which I still have. So that's actually the good part that came out of Cloudy with Chance of Meatballs. But then when they came to me and said, look, we're going to, a couple of years later, and said, we're going to make it all better by, we're going to do the Lego Movie. And I thought, I don't know what that means. And then, and we want you to play Batman. I thought, okay, great. Well, these guys, I'm in good hands. And of course, the movie turned out to be so much more than even I had hoped it to be.
Yeah.
And so when they said, we're going to make the Lego Batman film, and Chris McKay is going to direct it, who had been a big integral part of the success of the first one. He's such a brilliant guy. He said, McKay is going to be the captain of the ship. He's directing it, and we're going to produce it. I just knew that I was with such a great team, and it's such a collaborative, putting these films together, these animated films, is such a collaborative effort. You need a good captain, and McKay is a great captain, and Lord and Miller are great captains. But you really need, the team needs to be solid. So I never felt nervous that I was out there on a limb on my own. Of course, yes, it's the Lego Batman movie, and it is all about his story, but I had a great team. And then you've got Zach Galifianakis, and you got Michael Cera and Rosario Dawson, and then Ralph Fiennes playing Alfred. And he's so good in
it. So funny.
So funny, so good, so dry, so sweet. And it's a great story, and it all adds up. So... Yeah. Yeah.
Talking of Zach, this is quite a different Batman film because, you know, without saying too much, this is essentially a relationship story between the Joker to an extent and Batman, which is a route we've never seen before. So how did you kind of react when you first saw that script?
Well, you know, first of all, the way it works in animation, there is a script, but also it's a constantly changing thing. So it's not like there's a 90-page script that exists and that we just work off that. It's pieces and pieces. And, you know, with what we were working off in the different pages we had, Zach and I actually sort of a while ago got into the room together, and we spent an afternoon kind of finding that relationship.
Okay.
And we read and we improvised a lot and kind of helped to establish that dynamic.
Yeah.
And McKay had a really great idea of the direction he wanted us to go. And once we kind of zeroed in on the idea that it was kind of like there was almost like a lover spat going on, we knew we were onto something that was kind of gold. And it was great considering how marble mouth and what a terrible speaker Zach is. And it's so hard to get his redneck accent out of him. But we were able to scrub it.
Yeah. He's very, very fun. Scrub it.
No, I'm kidding.
He's very fun though in that.
He is fun.
And it's no imitation of any other Joker. Like, it's just his own. He's just having
fun. It's really Zach's own poor intellect really shows through.
This film plays with the idea of all the Batman past.
Yes.
And there are quite a few. Did you basically have the rights to everything? Was there anything you couldn't get that you know the guys wanted to get in the film?
No, not really. I think that in terms of Batman stuff, we were able to kind of go where we wanted to.
Yeah.
There were moments, I will say, that I spent a lot of time taking swipes at other properties.
Yeah.
That... some of them in-house and some of them owned by other people that they did not allow. And they were like, for obvious reasons, there was just no way they were going to let me put that in the movie.
Sure.
And I would sometimes hit it again and again and again, hoping that they would back them into a corner. They have to use it, but they didn't. But for the most part, no, they were really great about it. And letting us, you know, Lego Batman exists because I've had the luxury of being able to go back and look at all the other Batmen before, and through that I was able to kind of pick and choose and take my moments.
Do you actually feel in a way that you kind of miss out a little bit by not, you know, donning a real suit, by not being a live action Batman, or do you kind of go slightly method and wear the cowl in the booth?
Yeah. That would be a little hard. Those things are really uncomfortable. I wore the cowl and the suit at the Oscars a couple years ago.
Oh yeah, that was incredible.
When Everything Is Awesome when they performed that and they were like, hey, why don't you come up and just do a couple lines from your song, and I had Questlove as Robin with me. Yeah, and that was really, really fun. I got to wear that. There was originally a Val Kilmer suit, which they modified because I guess I'm about a foot taller than Val Kilmer. I don't know.
Goodness me. Okay.
I know. I always thought of him as a really tall guy.
Yeah. That's crazy, because that was my next question. I was going to say, like, how, you know, what was the story there? Did you literally just sort of go, hey, Val,
Warner Brothers owns it. So Warner Brothers wanted us to do it, and the studio sent it over, and we started fitting it, and they have a lot of these suits.
Yeah.
And I guess they tried to approximate which one was going to fit the best. Ben, the new one wasn't out yet, and they hadn't
so
even revealed
heavy
it. That
too,
one looks
surely.
So big. Yeah. Ben's taller than me, I think, and he's bigger. Like, he's sort of got big shoulders and arms and stuff. He's like a kick-ass Batman.
Yeah,
you know,
it's hardcore.
He's super hardcore. He looks like he could punch his way through a bank vault.
How do you think your Batman would do against his? Do
Not
you think
he
just
well.
Run away?
I'm just glad we're friends.
But,
yeah, okay. No, I think he's awesome.
You've got some pretty awesome toys in this film. I love the Scuttler, which is amazing.
Isn't that cool?
It is very, very cool. Do you have a certain favorite gadget or part of the Batcave that you just think is, you know, really, really good?
Well, you just took away Scuttler, which is so awesome. He's probably the best one.
So
I
good.
I know. Because imagine a vehicle that can just kind of do anything. Yeah. It can kind of climb mountains, literally. But there was some cool, there was the Zeppelin. Mm-hmm. I thought was pretty funny. I don't know when you'd have the opportunity to use the the bad Zeppelin.
Kayak's pretty cool.
Kayak's pretty good.
The kayak.
And some of those, you know, the costumes were, you know, all the different, the various Batman outfits that he had.
Yeah.
The thousands of them were pretty rad.
I think you've earned the right definitely to call yourself the Netflix king at the moment.
I keep telling people I don't like that. I prefer emperor.
Emperor, okay. So the Netflix emperor. BoJack is basically one of my favorite programs of all time. And I'm super excited for season two of Flicked, which you co-wrote and co-produced. What is it about the freedom of, you know, of Netflix that you love so much?
Yeah, they're just so artist friendly, you know, and I've really been very fortunate to be able to work there a lot over the last few years, and they've been really good to me, and you know, BoJack was something that a lot of other people I don't think had the vision to see as being something other than it was from the initial 13-minute presentation that we made, and to see the genius that is Raphael. You know, I had the good fortune to work there early on in when they were just starting to make original content. They had kind of House of Cards and Arrested Development.
Yeah.
And there were about four people working at Netflix at the time. It was crazy. I know. I feel like I'm like one of the first employees there. You know what I mean? I should have bought stock.
Yeah.
And or should have asked for it. And now I've seen it grow. And now, you know, we'll be on Flaked and they'll be like, "Hi, I'm so-and-so." I'm like, "What are you doing?" They're like, "Oh, I work for Netflix." Like, "Oh, what, you do? Since when?" "Since Tuesday." You know, their whole mantra is, "We hired you to do it. We're not going to tell you to do what you do.
Yeah.
We will try to help you do it the best way that we think that you can, but otherwise." And, you know, this season, you know, I'd never directed before. And even though I show ran with my partner, Mark Chappell, who's an Englishman, from Todd Margaret is how I know him, and which he did with David Cross. And this year, as we were sort of getting to think about directing, and Netflix was like, "Yeah, we're psyched. You should direct." Like, okay, you know,
that's exciting.
Hang on 1 second.
Well, we have to wrap it up. So finally, just to say, we hear, without giving anything away, we hear some rather inspirational Michael Jackson lyrics throughout this film. If you could very kindly sign off to our listeners with some imparting words of wisdom, something inspirational to get them through the rest of their day, that would be very kind.
I think at the end of the day, you've got to ask yourself, are you human or are you dancer? My signs are vital.
Amazing. Will Arnett, an absolute pleasure. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Thank you.
The lovely Will Arnett there. And if you want to hear more from Will Arnett or read more from Will Arnett, then there's a feature with him talking about all the big screen Batman to date. Batman's? Batman? He says Batman.
I say so, Batmon.
Really?
No.
No. So that's in a new issue of Empire, which is on sale now. And all good and evil news agents, just £4.50 of your money will get you that. And there's more stuff in there as well. But hey, anyway, a hard sell another time. Enough shameless plugs of Empire-related stuff. It's time to talk about movie news. Oh, hey, what's up? Oh, look, the nominations for the 3 Empire Awards have been announced.
Ah, tell me more about these Empire Awards.
So the Empire Awards are taking place March 19th in London at a top secret central London location, as close to McDonald's as possible, please, guys, if you can do that. I'm sure we haven't booked anywhere. McDonald's down the road might be available. You never know.
After party.
After party at Mackie D's, that'd be amazing. Leading the nominations is Rogue One, the Star Wars story, which has 9 nominations. Deadpool has 5 nominations. I think Deadpool himself cast a lot of votes for that one. Let's just run through some of the big nominations. Very, very exciting stuff. Best film presented by Sky Cinema. Hunt for the Wilder People, our film of 2016.
Yes.
Arrival.
Yes. I'm just going to say yes after every one of these.
Adam Lallana Land.
What?
Oh.
Rogue One, a Star Wars story.
Yep.
Yep.
Deadpool.
Okay.
Now, that's 5 very, very interesting, diverse films, and we reflect. And this is what I love about the Empire Awards over the years. You guys, the little people at home,
me and Nick,
vote for these. Mm-hmm. Right? So they reflect the tastes of the moviegoers, as opposed, you know, to the Academy,
the liberal
elite, Oscars, the Hollywood Foreign Press Association, up there in their ivory towers.
It's the will of the people, is what we're saying.
Yeah.
So you can't vote against any of these films.
Yeah. 52% of you voted for these movies. And the rest of us have to accept it and go along with it.
So this has gone off the rails. This has gone off the rails. This has turned into a podcast X. Podcast X.
Exit.
Exit.
Yeah. So that's exciting. Best British Film, presented by The Hollywood Reporter. High Rise, solid. Yep. I, Daniel Blake, solid. Mm-hmm. The Girl with All the Gifts, solid. Fantastic Beasts and Where to Find Them, mm-hmm. solid. Mm-hmm. Small Films. and Eddie the Eagle.
Oh, yeah.
It's good.
Yeah.
It's good.
Nice to see some of the films that we love getting recognition.
To see them nice.
To see them nice.
Pretty sure our dad has voted for Eddie the Eagle. He said that was the best film he's seen for about 20 years.
I haven't spoken to him about that, really.
Really loved it.
Eddie the Eagle's a very lovable film.
It is. It's just very a sweet. Nice, happy. Very good music as well.
I happen
really
to know who's a big fan of the Nice Guys screenplay, which has been nominated for Best Screenplay.
Oh, what else has been nominated for Best Screenplay, Phil?
Hunt for the World of People.
Okay.
No Child Gets Left Behind. No Script Gets Left Behind. That's our motto. That's my motto. Hello, High Water, which is a cracking script. We watched that film again a couple of weeks ago. Stands up, fantastic.
That film...
Really good to see that getting Oscar nomination as well, whilst we're on the subject, because it came out such a long time ago with so little fanfare, and it's gathered... And it's just, I think its quality has spoken for it, really.
We'll be talking about the BAFTAs in a second as well. And that film's really interesting to me because Jeff Bridges is the one who got all the acting heat from that. And he's very, very good in it. And he's been nominated for an Oscar and a BAFTA, Best Supporting Actor and all that sort of stuff. Ben Foster and Chris Pine are every bit as good.
They are.
And you know, Chris Pine in particular is doing something that we've never really seen him do before.
I came out of it
having
thinking...
a moustache.
Having a moustache.
I came out of it thinking Chris Pine was probably the secret MVP of that one because he was stretching himself in new directions and I didn't know he could do that.
Mm.
I mean, not like, physically,
Ben Reed Richards.
Stretcheroony. But, you know, doing new stuff. Ben Foster, we know, can act, obviously. But,
yeah. I didn't quite believe that they were brothers, but maybe, I don't know, they got different dads. Maybe.
I think it's pretty integral to the script that they do have the same parents. But you're right, there's a certain...
Same mother, certainly.
No, you're right. Maybe. Anyway, other best screenplays, Deadpool, Arrival, and The Nice Guys.
Wow.
Yeah.
Those are good screenplays.
That's very solid.
Those are
solid
good screenplays. Best director presented by Few Entertainment, Taika Waititi for Hunt for the Wilder People, Denis Villeneuve for Arrival is Denis Villeneuve, Ken Loach... Andrea Arnold for American Honey, that's a good nomination. And Gareth Edwards for Rogue One, A Star Wars Story. It's all good stuff. And the one that I always love this guy. Oh, Best Horror is good. Under the Shadow.
Yeah.
The Witch.
Yep.
Green Room. Conjuring 2. Don't Breathe. Good stuff.
Good stuff.
Categories I always love are the best male and female newcomers. So best male newcomer is Julian Dennison, Hunt for the Wilder People. Lewis McDougall for Monster Calls. Riz Ahmed for Rogue One, A Star Wars Story. Mm-hmm. Interesting choice. Yep. Dave Johns for I, Daniel Blake and Tom Holland for Captain America Civil War, which didn't get Best Film nomination, which is surprising. Best Female Newcomer, Anya Taylor-Joy for The Witch, Senya Nanua for The Girl with All the Gifts, Sasha Lane for American Honey, Hayley Squires for I, Daniel Blake, which got a lot of love in our awards, and Anjali Rice for The Nice Guys. It's all very interesting, isn't it?
Good stuff. Just quickly, lastly, best TV series. What would you pick from Game of Thrones, Stranger Things, The Night Manager, Sherlock, and Westworld?
I'd pick MasterChef: The Professionals.
Yeah,
Stranger Things.
Yeah,
Stranger Things, definitely.
Yeah.
Westworld, I loved the first half of, but lost me a little bit by the end. Sherlock, I didn't love. Game of Thrones is always great. You kind of get used to how good Game of Thrones is, but it did have a good season. This one, much better than the one before. But yeah, Strange Things.
I would pick Fleabag and Yonderland from that selection.
Ooh, Fleabag's a good pick, although not actually a pick.
Actually want me to stick the ones that are nominated?
Ideally.
Yeah.
MasterChef of Professionals.
MasterChef of Professionals.
Gets his own category.
Yeah.
Obviously.
That was such a good season this year. I thought it was really good.
Is it sizzling?
It was sizzling. It was so tame.
Where's Bake Off?
Bake Off? Bake Off, I'm not as in love with Bake Off as other people are.
Okay.
But, you know, still good, solid entertainment. Right. And I'm glad to see it's back on our screens this year on Channel 4.
And the BAFTAs, worth mentioning, has actually shifted from its iconic home of the Royal Opera House.
Has it?
Royal Opera House.
Has it?
The Royal Opera House. Is that where it's based? It's iconic.
Where is it?
It is the Royal Opera House. Yes, they obviously
has it shifted or not? Because I'm meant to be hosting something there, and I kind of need to know where it is.
Yeah, it's at the Emirates Stadium in North London, Chris. So enjoy.
It's at Mackie D's down the corner.
Kicks off at 9 a.m.
It's at your flat right now
tomorrow.
They're all waiting for you.
If you see me in the McDonald's on the bottom of Charing Cross Road on Sunday,
wearing a tux
and looking slightly confused.
Interviewing a packet of French fries,
and wondering why people aren't showing up at BAFTAs, then that'll be why. Where is it?
Good to see you across the minutiae of this one.
I get all
I believe
my
it's the Royal Albert Hall.
Really?
Yeah.
Are you making this up?
This is genuine news.
Are you making this up?
No, this is true.
Is this actually true? This is amazing.
Yeah.
You're like Tom for me. So where should I get off? What's the nearest tube stop?
Well, that would be South Kensington.
South Ken.
And then it's a
that's
all right.
That's on the Piccadilly line. That's good for me.
Easy. We'll get into the train times after the podcast. It's probably best.
Do you have any alternative travel tips for Chris? Feel free to tweet or Facebook or
is it really
email
the Royal
us
Albert
at
Hall?
Empire.
That's amazing. I genuinely thought it was the Royal Opera House again. That's amazing.
No, it's the Royal Albert Hall. Wow. Sunday, the 12th of February, Chris.
Let's do some news that doesn't involve Chris's travel plans.
Just quickly on the BAFTAs before we move on. Best film nominations there are Arrival, I, Daniel Blake, La La Land, Manchester by the Sea and Moonlight.
What do we want to win, the best picture? I want Arrival. Ooh. I've decided.
Have you?
I want Arrival to win. Gosh. I don't think it's going to win. I don't think it's going to win at the Oscars either, but I want Arrival to win. It's a damn good film.
Go through the nominations again. Best film:
Arrival,
uh-huh.
I, Daniel Blake,
uh-huh.
or One Daniel Blake, La La Land, Manchester by the Sea, or Moonlight.
See, I think La La Land will win, but don't rule out I, Daniel Blake doing well.
Uh huh.
Yep.
It's a good crop of films this year.
It is a good crop of films. I think I, Daniel Blake will certainly win Best British Film.
Yeah,
but it could, you know, because you never know. The BAFTAs, sometimes they do go a little bit local. Like they do go local films for local people.
It's a lock for Best Daniel Blake.
It's
stiff competition this year, but
yeah, he might just sneak it from Danny Blake.
And as usual, I think you can watch it on television. And Chris may or may not be there.
My mind has been blown.
Yeah,
it's important that I know where the BAFTAs is being held.
I know.
Are you going this year?
No, I'm not allowed back after the whole BAFTA. Yeah, so I think that's partly why they move venues.
Still mopping up from last time.
Oh, yeah.
The spectre of Phil's sickness haunts the place like the Babadook.
BAFTA Duke.
The Babapook.
Oh, Babapook.
The BAFTA Puke. There we go. We got the high fives, everybody. No, we got there in the end.
We really need Helen to come back.
Yeah.
Helen,
bring
come
Helen
back.
Can I mention a story that's not awards related, which involves Steve McQueen? Erstwhile of this podcast has got a new movie out called Widows, and he is recruiting Elizabeth Debicki, the willowy Aussie from such films as The Great Gatsby and the Empire Awards nominated The Night Manager, which is not a film obviously, but you know what I mean. It's filmed. They use a camera to make it, and she's in talks for this. This is also includes Moonlight's Andre Holland, and it's written with McQueen and Gone Girl's writer and novelist Gillian Flynn. So an interesting amalgamation of talent for this
one.
This
is a remake of the 1980s TV show?
Yep, 1983 miniseries about caper gone wrong.
Yeah, on ITV. I remember
that
show.
I think caper, when they say caper, they're not referring to the small green pickle.
But they might be.
Who knows? Nope, hang on, I'm reading further. The story follows four armed robbers who were killed in a failed heist attempt, leaving their widows, hence the title, to finish the job. And Debicki is going to be playing one of the widows. Interesting, sounds like an interesting sort of more of a genre vibe from McQueen, but who knows?
That sounds good. Yeah. I suspect it will not be a caper.
He doesn't make
He doesn't
that
seem
make,
like
no.
a director prone to capering, and no. That sounds a bit heavy for a caper, but no, it sounds good. It sounds interesting.
It does. That's it. That is interesting.
No, she's a very, very good actress, and you can see her briefly for the first time in the Guardians of the Galaxy Volume 2 Super Bowl teaser trailer. It was only a minute long, but you see her character for the first time, and she's great. She was really good, and one of the best things about The Man from U.N.C.L.E. I know that's damning with faint praise, but yeah, she's very, very good.
She's also in the Cloverfield follow-up God Particle as well, which is coming later this year. So more Debicki.
Debicki business
taking
is
the biscuit.
Debicki booming. So Jack Nicholson is back.
Solidly awful wordplay all around there. Jack Nicholson's back.
Jack Nicholson's back. Jack's back. This is genuinely amazing news, because I'm pretty sure, well, I heard from somebody that he had properly retired, and that was only like 3 or 4 months ago. So he's back. Apparently, he saw Tony Erdmann, the new art house movie, and he loved it. And he loved it so much, he decided to make another version of it.
Yeah. Well, Tony Erdmann, as people are probably aware, is a 5-star humdinger of a slightly different stripe. It's 3 hours long, and it's German, and it's comedy, but it is brilliant. And I'm not just saying that because I like things that are German and 3 hours long. It's also nominated for the Best Foreign Film Oscar, and I think it's probably a strong prospect to win that, potentially. I actually interviewed the director, Marinadi, for her version of the film, obviously, quite recently, and she was saying that there were those talks with Hollywood about a remake. I mean, there's a long, you know, tradition of Hollywood remaking six critically acclaimed European films in America, but I think this is great. Having seen the film and loved it, I think this is really good casting. It's obviously exciting to see Jack Nicholson back,
because, yeah,
like you, I mean, it's been what, 7 years?
It's been 7 years.
So
in 2010, he starred in How Do You Know, the film which should have a question mark.
How do you know?
Because I'm looking it up.
Oh, okay.
It's an annoyingly punctuated James L. Brooks film.
How do you know?
Because I'm looking it up.
Okay.
And before that, I'm Still Here, he popped up in that. I don't remember him popping up in that, but the Casey Affleck Joaquin Phoenix film. And then before that, it was 2007, The Bucket List, the Rob Reiner cancer comedy, which he starred in with Morgan Freeman.
And then before that, it was The Departed.
Yeah, so he's barely done anything for a decade. This is really exciting.
I think it's great. If you're not familiar with the story, it's about Tony Erdmann is the alter ego of a father figure, Winfried Conradi, who surprises, he lives in Germany, flies to Bucharest to surprise his daughter, played by Sandra Hüller, whose role will be taken by Kristen Wiig in the remake. He kind of adopts this crazed alter ego Tony Erdmann, who has fake teeth and just loves practical joking. There's a scene with a whoopee cushion, which is old school, and it's kind of it defies description, really, but it kind of, over 3 hours, it covers a lot of stuff. It's very funny and very heartwarming, and it features one of the greatest nude scenes in cinema, and highly recommended. And I just think that they've probably nailed the casting, and people are saying Kristen Wiig maybe too broad comically, but I think she does good dramatic work. We saw her
That's crazy.
We saw her in The Martian. We saw her in
Skeleton Twins.
Walter Mitty. I mean, she's good at that.
And she's fantastic. She can do anything. Kristen Wiig.
Yeah, and also that, you know, I having seen this, I really feel that's good casting from that point of view, and I think the two of them together will be great.
So Adam McKay's involved as
Will
producer.
Ferrell. Will Ferrell's also producing.
Yeah, so I'm excited about this. Question is it going to be nearly 3 hours long?
And is it going to be called? What's it going to be called? And the other issue, I think, the other sort of moment of pause is this is very specifically about the corporate world, and about, you know, cultures colliding in strange places, expats at work. You know, it's set in Bucharest. He's German, she's German. There's Romanian. There's a lot of things going on culturally, which you're going to have to move to another sort of setting, and an American setting. People are speculating, will she be in Mexico? Will he fly to see her in Mexico? I don't know. But, you know, see the film and let us know what you think about the idea.
America itself, there are so many different countries almost within America itself. They could go to the Deep South, they could go whoever, you could go anywhere.
I hope people get wind of this and then think they want to go and see the film that's out now, because it's well worth it.
I'm always a little bit kind of wary of, you know, when a great foreign language film comes out and then they just announce a Hollywood remake straight away, you kind of go, well, can't people just watch the original? But I think the fact that Nicholson is driving this, apparently he saw a screener and he phoned up the head of Paramount himself and said, I want to make this.
That's awesome.
That's exciting.
Yeah, that's
because
awesome.
You want to see another great Jack Nicholson performance.
What you don't want is, you know, the secret in their eyes scenario, where there's a great Argentine film that's very specific to that time and place that's transposed into America and made into a really bang average kind of generic thriller, which I could not recommend less.
But I don't feel there was any momentum behind that film. I think when it came out, everyone was like, they made that film, okay. This feels like it has real momentum. For example, the film that doesn't have momentum was The Raid remake, which was announced a few years ago, had a director,
Frank Grillo, is that right?
Frank Grillo was going to be in it, so it was Ethan Hawke, I believe, and then it just vanished. Yeah. Vanished into the ether. And you kind of feel that the moment has passed for that, if they announce The Raid tomorrow, or Train to Busan is another film they're trying to remake at the moment.
Yeah.
And it feels like that moment has passed. This, it feels like this movie has momentum behind it. And if Jack Nicholson, if he is, I am hugely excited about this. I know that some people are poo-pooing it, but this this is one of the screen greats of any generation. And if he wants to get in front of a camera again, and even if he is just playing the thinly veiled Jack Nicholson, I'm okay with that. That is fine by me.
Yeah.
Very excited.
It's exciting, yeah. You know, it's like if Gene Hackman suddenly decided to do another film.
Don't, man.
No,
that would be awesome.
No, don't
awesome.
Tease me with that.
But I mean, it's that level of...
The man's last movie was Welcome to Mooseport. You know what I mean? It's just like,
he might,
you know.
I've heard he's developing Welcome to Mooseport 2. Colon,
it's
back
not
to
a
Mooseport.
Terrible film. It's just...
I've not seen it. I've got to confess.
It could have been, you know...
You interviewed him.
I interviewed
him,
final
ever interview with Gene Hackman, right?
Well, that's... guilty somewhat, but I did an interview with I hope it's not the final interview with Gene Hackman. I hope he's around for many years and does many interviews with many people. I interviewed him because he writes books. He's a novelist, and he retired a few years ago, as he told me, because of some health issues. And yeah. I think that's why he hasn't come back. He doesn't sound like, this is a couple of years ago now, but he didn't sound like he was missing it. But I just, you look at someone's filmography. And before Welcome to Mooseport, there's Royal Tenenbaums. And then there's Welcome to Mooseport. And he just goes, come on, Gene, just make one more. Yeah. Come on, Sir Sean, just make one more so your last film is not Sir Billy LaFette.
Yeah.
Just...
Apparently he turned up on the set of Four. Did you hear this?
Who?
The first
Hackman
Four. Gene Hackman, because he lives close to where they were filming.
Yeah, he lives in New Mexico, yeah.
Yeah, so he just turned up with his wife on the set one day. And was like, hey, what's going on?
That's awesome. Amazing.
So he could have been in it. But anyway.
He has been in stuff. I mean, not movies, but there was a TV show. Like, you know, one of those, not Man versus Food, but something like that. Like
Hackman versus Food.
Hackman versus Hack Food. And, where this guy, I was just watching one day on like the Food Channel or something. And there was this program where this guy goes around and he was in Santa Fe. And Gene Hackman was in his...
Amazing.
The place that he'd gone to. And he ended up interviewing Gene Hackman.
That's amazing.
But I rewatched No Way Out the other night, and that's such a good
movie.
Film.
Yeah,
Will Patton is so good in that film, but Hackman, just, he is one of the greats.
And he's actually my favourite actor of the last whatever. I'm going to just put that out there.
Yeah.
So I would love to see him again, and Jack Nicholson,
and Pesci,
and
come on, guys,
you name it.
Oh.
All these guys together in a sort of Expendables team up.
Well, Pesci was, there was talk of him coming back for the Irishman, which is hopefully the next Scorsese film, or one of the next Scorsese films, which apparently they're going to have a CG Robert De Niro for half of it, because they're de-aging him for the early scenes.
Yeah, as he mentioned on the Emperor podcast.
Of course,
last year.
And Pesci is apparently, that they've written a role for him, but now he's kind of going, hey, Marty, I don't know. Anyway, we've gone off topic.
Yep.
let's get back to some actual news.
I got some more news. If you've seen Fleabag, which you should have done because it's flipping excellent, Phoebe Waller-Bridge, the creator and star of that show, is being signing up, might be circling whatever, the Han Solo movie, which is extraordinary news, really. I can only assume she'll be like in the cantina throughout, just on it.
Cantina throughout, just on it. Recycling my own joke, I hope she plays a character called Ilan Fleabagano, because there's a character called Ilan Sleazebagano in a 5-star rated Attack of the Clones. He's the guy who tries to sell death sticks to Obi-Wan Kenobi. You know the guy?
Yeah. Is that what he's called?
It's a 5-star scene.
He's called Ilan Sleazebagano.
Okay.
You want to buy some death sticks? You don't want to sell me death sticks.
Okay.
You want to go home and rethink your life? Okay. I want to go home and rethink my life.
Death sticks. Come on, George.
Yeah, that's great. I love Fleabag, and Phoebe Waller-Bridge is amazing. And stick Phoebe Waller-Bridge in all the movies. Have her write all the movies. Have her star in all the movies. Mm-hmm. Have her do those little asides to the camera in all the movies.
Mm-hmm.
In fact, you can lose the whole Han Solo thing and just make it about her. That'd be great.
Mm-hmm. Apparently, the role will be a CG-driven performance.
No.
Yes.
Unacceptable.
Apparently.
CG bag. My wordplay is not quite at peak level today.
I was finally ill last night. I have some sort of excuse.
I've got no excuse and no shame.
All right. Is that it? Is there anything else?
It's quite a light...
The light spring
week. Oh, I know what we wanted to talk about. We were talking about this beforehand. The fact that Paramount this week took two movies off their schedule completely.
Yeah.
One is World War Zed.
Z.
Two. No.
Z.
No.
Z.
No. And the other one is Friday the 13th, the latest remake of that franchise.
Of what's that film called? Yeah. I'm sad about one of those.
Which one?
World War Z. Z.
C.
Two. I really like the first one.
T.
Apart from the scene where Brad Pitt as Jerry, his mobile phone goes off on the airbase, which is just really irritating. Whenever that happens in a film, I lose all sympathy for the character. So I'm just like, put your phone on silent. It happened in another thriller I saw recently, where the phone goes off.
Trainspotting 2.
Trainspotting 2. Exactly. And I just go, nope, you're an idiot. You deserve to die. If that happened. Genuinely, you deserve to die if you don't put your phone on silent.
I would love it if your phone went off just now.
Colin.
No, especially if you're in a life or death situation. With zombies and so on. But I know I liked that film quite a lot. Didn't love it, but I liked it quite a lot enough to want to watch another one, especially with Juan Antonio Bayona. Was it him?
Yes, it was. It was Juan Antonio Bayona. Yep. He was gonna, and Stephen Knight was brought on to write the screenplay. So this had a good pedigree. And then obviously, Bayona just didn't, well, for whatever reason, didn't come together. Bayona went on to direct Jurassic World 2, which starts filming any minute now. And, you know, it just feels to me that maybe, once again, we're talking about that word momentum. It sounds like a football podcast, but, you know, the momentum fell away from the project. And there were rumors a couple of months ago that they were trying to get David Fincher, that Brad Pitt, still trying to make this movie happen. He was trying to get David Fincher to direct it, but it feels like it's just going to slide quietly away into the night. And I'm kind of okay with that. Because I liked the first film. The first film surprised me. And obviously it went through so many public trials, but it turned out all right. But I'm not desperate to see what happens next in the continuing adventures of Jerry Lane. And also, I kind of feel that it wrapped itself up.
Yeah.
It was one of those weird films. Like, we talk all the time in the podcast about how a lot of movies make the mistake these days of leaving themselves wide open for a sequel in a fit of optimism. And weirdly enough, World War Zed, which was always mooted as part of a big new franchise, does kind of,
well, it has
they,
that kind
they,
of
they do those, discover
they have that montage of all of the scenes that they cut from the film, a different ending.
Yeah,
so it does kind of like give you a global scale.
I mean, I still think there's potential in the epic imagery that they could have done with that series that, say, The Walking Dead maybe can't do. But there are images in the book it's based on with, you know, a submarine being taken over by underwater zombies and stuff.
Paris catacombs.
Yeah, I just feel like there's potential for a really epic, huge zombie film, which we haven't seen. And there were tastes of that in some of the scenes in the first one.
Yeah.
I think they could push it further. I would be on board. I would be on board for another one.
Perhaps the feeling is now we're in a situation, though, where right now the marketplace is, you know, you have 2, maybe 3 years max between sequels. Otherwise, you lose that currency, you lose that recognition. You know, we're in a situation now where, you know, whether it's a Marvel or DC or Star Wars, but we're getting those movies every year, sometimes 2 or 3 times a year. So you don't forget. You know what I mean? Whereas I feel if a World War Zed 2 comes out in 2019, 2020, you might need to have a pamphlet handed to moviegoers as they go in just to remind you what the first film was.
Pacific Rim is going to be 5 years between films, isn't it?
Is Pacific Rim 5 years?
Yeah.
Oh, wow. Yeah.
Okay. 2013, and then the next one's out next year.
Yeah, that's also... These are gambles. I mean, the thing is, you know, Pacific Rim made $400 million worldwide. That's a gamble. You push the button on a sequel at that point, and it could go either way. Next one could come out, and people could go, oh, yeah, Pacific Rim. I love Pacific Rim. I'll go and see that again. Hmm. And it makes $600, $700 million worldwide, and then becomes...
Just start the film with previously on Pacific Rim.
That's what it needs to do.
Yeah.
Cancel the apocalypse.
Needs to have Phoebe Waller-Bridge recapping all the films to camera.
Yes. You remember, it's full of your favourite characters like Clanky McRobot Face and Chuck Yeager.
Chuck Yeager.
Chuck Yeager.
And then Friday the 13th got canned as well. And that yeah. seems to maybe be canned.
Can. Mm. Doing the can.
Are you upset about that?
No.
Okay. No. We're excited about the new Halloween, aren't we?
We are.
Because John Carpenter's getting involved.
Yeah.
And it's Jason Blum.
Yeah. I mean, yeah, we're excited. We're excited.
It's more excited than you would generally be about a Halloween film.
Yeah, I'm excited about that.
Okay.
Damn it. Good. Yes, I'm
agreed.
Excited about that.
Agreed.
And we should be excited as well. We should mention as well that Corin Hardy's The Nun, which got greenlit after last week's podcast.
Which I have suggested to him that he retitle Blood Wimple. It's frankly a better title. Corin, you know it's true.
Can we stop verbally retweeting ourselves?
Did you? I'm sure that was good sounds tweet, new to me. Was it good? No, was that a tweet?
That was a tweet.
That was a tweet.
Sorry. I've retweeted myself.
I'm just glad that someone else came up with a nun pun beyond habit, nun, rosary, because I was out. After those three, I was done.
I tweeted those. Yeah.
Okay. Well, you're not alone, mate. You're not alone with your tweets.
Have there been a lot of evil nun films?
I can't think of too many evil nun films, but what's interesting about this is it's good to see Corin Hardy getting another movie, because I know he's been trying to get The Crow off the ground, of course, formerly of this podcast, a couple of times actually. He's been trying to get a couple of movies off the ground, so it's good to see this happening. But what's interesting about this as well is that The Nun is a spin-off of the Conjuring movies, and so at this point, when that movie comes out, there will be more Conjuring spin-offs than there actually are Conjuring movies.
That's true.
Which
there'll
is,
be Annabelle 2.
Yeah, and The Nun.
Wow.
Yeah.
Well, look, if this nun is more scary than the one in the Blues Brothers, then that's going to be absolutely
the
terrifying.
Penguin.
The Penguin, yeah. Oh, my God. Right. Yeah, no, there's potential. I'm looking forward to that.
It's all good. Okay, so that's it for movie news. And now, a word about our sponsor, mustard.co.uk. Life is all about options. We all know that. But when it comes to getting the right car, van, or motorbike insurance, how do you know you've chosen the right policy? Well, at mustard.co.uk, their online price guarantee means you get exactly what you need from some of the best deals on the market. So remember, when it comes to getting you great insurance, you can count on mustard.co.uk. So whoever you are, whatever you drive, get comparing and see if you can get cover for less with mustard.co.uk. Okay, our last guest this week is one of the greatest actors of all time, period. And we know this because just before we came in to do the podcast, we did a Sporkle quiz, seeing how many of his films we could name. 46 films. And he's done a lot of classics.
Yeah. Uh-huh.
Crimson Tide.
Yeah.
Glory.
Out of Time.
Training Day. Out of Time is one we didn't get. Philadelphia. He's done tons. Oh. Tons.
Yeah.
Because he's Denzel Washington. We should mention that. He's Denzel Washington, of course. He has directed before in the past, but never as successfully as with this week's Fences, an adaptation of August Wilson's play. He's been nominated for Best Actor for it as well. It's all very, very exciting. I went along to talk to Denzel after we recorded this, so let's hope it goes well. Enjoy. We are delighted to be joined on the Empire Podcast by Denzel Washington, director and star of Fences. How are you, sir?
I'm great, thank you.
Good. Are you jet lagged? You okay?
Yeah, I'm, in and out. I'm trying to not eat too much at this time of day because I'm feeling like that afternoon wave that hits you.
Uh-huh.
Yeah.
Uh-huh. I know it well. I live in that afternoon wave. That's my perpetual state. congratulations on the film. It's an amazing achievement.
Thank
and
you.
this is a piece of work, Fences, that has been in your life one way or another for about 20-30 years. I read an interview, you said you first saw this performed with James Earl Jones.
But it wasn't in my life. I saw it in the 80s with James Earl Jones and Mary Alice and Courtney Vance, and was moved by it. I mean, I was closer to Corey's age than to Troy.
Yeah.
But about 7 years ago or more, 7 years ago, Scott Rudin gave me a call about a screenplay. Asked me if I wanted to direct it, produce it. So I read it, and I realized I had never read the play. I'd seen it. So I read the play, and I called him back and said, let's do the play. And he said, you want to do the play?
He mustn't have been expecting that.
No, I don't think he did. I said, and I'm glad I did, because number one, we had great success.
Yeah.
Number one is great play. Start there. We had great success with the play. I found out, okay, I can do the part. Because, for him to say, let's do the movie. And I'm like, well, am I right for the movie or whatever? But once we did the play and the success we had at the play, and those great performances from Viola and Stephen Henderson and everybody, then it took me another 2 or 3 years. I had some other projects lined up and backed up. And, you know, life.
Yeah.
And about 2.5 years ago, I said, all right, let's go. And that was a process leading up to finishing the film in November.
So it was a slightly misleading question, and it made it sound like you've been obsessing about this play for the last 30 years. Yeah. But what I was interested in was your reaction when you first saw it back in 87. You saw James, an amazing cast.
Actually, again, because I was younger,
yeah.
It wasn't like I said, oh, I want to be Troy one day.
Yeah.
I related, not to say I related, but what I remember is the mom.
Okay.
And maybe because my parents are divorced and I was very close to my mother. You know, so I've been telling people about this film, and I've been saying this over and over. When people ask me, what do you want people to get from it? I say it depends upon what they bring to it. So for me, maybe at that point in my life or whatever, that's what I remember.
Yeah.
I mean, obviously, I remember the great James Earl Jones.
Yeah.
But something about maybe that's just inherent in the material, because no one is going to say they don't remember Viola Davis.
This is true. So as an actor, especially at the time, I mean, thinking about your career at that time, it was around the time of Cry Freedom.
Mm-hmm.
It was around the time that you were leaving St. Elsewhere and you were really striking out and becoming...
Well, before I was leaving, 86, 87.
Yeah, yeah.
I didn't leave it. They sent us home.
Yeah, that's true.
In 88.
In the little snow cone.
Oh, that's right. You know that?
I know that.
Oh, wow. It was all a dream or something,
it's
right?
All a dream, yeah. Right. So you managed to escape the snow globe, and you're striking out on your own as an actor. I mean, as a movie star as well. I'm just fascinated when you watch a play like this to see the roles that you zero in on as an actor. And it's fascinating that back in the day, it wasn't Troy that was the big appeal to you. That intrigues me.
Well, I you know, you don't go to a play, or I didn't go to that play. Mm. I didn't know what I was going to see. First of all, I hadn't read it when I saw James Earl Jones do it and all of that.
Yeah.
And just like I don't project to what I might be doing when I'm 90, if I'm around now. You know what I'm saying? I'm not thinking about, oh, that's a great 80-year-old part I should play one day. You know what I'm saying? You don't.
Absolutely.
You know, you go, you enjoy the theater. I actually, again, when I read the play and it said 53, I guess what I thought was, I can't even say that, but maybe I didn't think I was old enough, or I didn't know. I really didn't know how old Troy was.
Yeah.
I know I was much younger than James Earl Jones, or I knew that, or I felt that he was much older than me at that time. And for whatever reason, I hadn't read it.
So you you did the play in 2010, to great success, as you said. Then it was a few years between that and getting the film off the ground.
Mm-hmm.
When you went back to playing Troy, as well as you have this other job of directing the thing, was it easy to find him again? Was it like riding a bike?
Well, with one pedal. That's a pretty good analogy, right? I thought, you think you remember all the lines.
Yeah.
And you can't remember them specifically.
Uh-huh.
You know, I could paraphrase. So I had, for other reasons, I had an extensive rehearsal period. Because number one, we had to cast a new young man, a young boy, Corey, because the other guy was too old, the kid who did it, you know, on Broadway. And we had to cast a girl. So I wanted enough time to catch them up. I wanted a longer rehearsal period. And I hired these young kids to understudy every part. Not forget standing in. You got to be off book, learn the blocking, be ready. Do everything we did. I got a big gymnasium in a church, and we taped out the backyard, kitchen, front room, dining room, upstairs, the street, everything, so that we could work it almost like a play.
Uh-huh. Wow.
And then I could plug in and understudy anytime I wanted. Sometimes after we would rehearse, I'd send them home and I'd rehearse with the understudies. And now I could stand out as the director.
Oh, cool.
Because I knew, not so much for their performance, I wasn't rehearsing that, but where they're going to be. So Charlotta, the cinematographer, and I would walk around. Even when we would do that sometimes in the evening after I finished rehearsing with the other actors. Then we'd come in with the other actors and she'd walk around.
Okay.
And I'd have, you know, she'd find places to stand and she's making notes. And then when they went home, she and I would go through that. And, you know, preparation is the key.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Absolutely. I've asked a number of actor directors this. But again, I'm fascinated by the process. When you have a big day of acting ahead of you, and you're the director, How do you compartmentalize that? Do you have someone who watches your performance for you? Do you gauge it yourself?
I would imagine that every director that you, actor director that you ask, wasn't directing a play. No, I'm just saying that because we had it in our bones already and we knew what worked.
Yeah.
We didn't have to find it on the day. Mm-hmm. You know, we won the Tony Award for Best Revival. So my job was not to screw it up. He already won the Pulitzer Prize. He already won all these Tonys. My job was not to screw it up. So it wasn't like on the day. It would have been, if I had not done the play, I couldn't have directed and acted in the film.
Okay.
It would have been impossible. Yeah. The guy doesn't shut up for 22 minutes.
This is very true. Yeah. He's a very gregarious guy.
Yeah.
But there's also a lot of, there's an anger that burns inside Troy as well. Is it easy to access that as an actor?
Again, it depends upon what you bring to it.
Yeah.
I never use the word anger.
Oh, okay.
Frustration.
Frustration, yeah.
Yeah, frustration. You know, there's a very interesting arc in that scene with his son, Corey, when they're cutting the boards. Yeah. Because it really starts off very lovely, very, very nice, and they're laughing about things. And where Troy is frustrated about his past with baseball, and the boys feels comfortable enough to talk about, well, you know, what about that other play? He was good. He was that. He was this. He was that. And then he says, I'm through with it now.
Yeah.
Then you go, uh-oh.
Yeah, yeah.
And it didn't start off to be that.
Yeah.
Then that's like step one. Then he goes into, so your mama said you down at the A&Ps, and then he finds out he's not working, and it goes to, you know. And then really in the midst of that, some of what can appear to be anger, mm-hmm. he's actually teaching him about responsibility. You know, and he says, the man doesn't give me my money because he likes me. He gives it to me because he owes me.
Yes.
You know, yeah. Don't you go through life worrying about whether people like you or not. That's what he says. You best be making sure they're doing right by you.
But he's a man who is clearly frustrated.
Absolutely.
By,
and anger's all right to use, but yeah. You know, but not all the time.
Yeah. I think certainly towards the end of the film, anger begins to manifest itself a little bit more.
Mm.
But he's a man who's frustrated by a ceiling that's been placed on him by society.
Mm.
And looking at the play now, obviously set in the 1950s, written in the 1980s, been revived a couple of times. Now we hear it as a movie. It feels as timely now as it probably did back in 1987.
That's what the great plays do.
Yeah.
That's why they're great plays. This isn't for this time. This is for all time.
Yeah.
Death of a Salesman, you know, apply where you like. You know? You know?
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah. As an actor, you've worked with a number of directors several times, Antoine Fuqua and Tony Scott, obviously Spike Lee, of course. Do you know when you've clicked with a director? Is this something that... There's a moment where you, I'm simpatico with this guy. I could roll with this guy a couple more times.
Each case is different.
Yeah.
I mean, in the case of Tony, we did Crimson Tide in, what was it, 94. And we didn't do another film for 10 years together.
That's true.
You know? So it also has to do with them calling you. You know? Spike, we did Mo Better Blues in 89, but we were already talking about Malcolm X.
Okay.
Then, because he had seen me do it 10 years earlier on stage.
Yeah.
So we had talked about it. We didn't know when, you know, I didn't know when he was going to make it or when we were going to make it, but we did start talking about it. Well, we didn't know because we didn't have the money yet, but we wanted to make it. I knew he wanted to make it.
Okay. And Antoine, is he, again, that's a director that you've worked with, obviously, Training Day. Then took a break.
Yeah, from Training Day was 2001, and then we came back together, what, how many years?
Well, Equalizer was 2014. So.
13, well, we did it in 13.
Yeah.
So, yeah, 10, 12 years. It's just the nature of it. You know, you're off to do something, sometimes schedule doesn't mix, and sometimes you just don't have the role.
Yeah. Tony Scott's fascinating because... if you watch Crimson Tide and then watch, say, The Taking of Pelham 1-2-3 or Deja Vu or even Unstoppable, his style
changed big time
as a director.
Man on Fire changed a lot.
Man on Fire is huge. And that was the moment, really.
Yeah. Well, he used to shoot these, I don't know what they call them, but like long commercials for BMW. I think they're more, you know what they call those? You know, I don't know. They do these long commercials. I don't know if that's for the people at BMW or whatever, but he'd practice. Because I remember him showing me this BMW commercial with Gary Oldman and James Brown. And you started to see he was practicing. Did you ever see that?
I saw that.
Yeah. One. So there's shots in there like Man on Fire.
Yeah.
So he shot that before Man on Fire, and he showed it to me to let me know where he was going. In fact, there's shots of them in the back of the car, sitting in the car.
Yes.
That he uses in Man on Fire.
Really?
Yeah. So I think that was his style, to practice. Like, for example, I hadn't directed in 8 or 9 years from Great Debaters. And a friend of mine, Debbie Allen, runs the show for Grey's Anatomy. Uh-huh. And she asked me to do an episode. And ordinarily, I was, you know, but I said, yeah, let me get back behind the camera before I make a movie. And it's television where they do 10 pages a day, which is tough. Uh-huh. So I said, yeah, that's even better. Let me feel how hard it is to do that.
Wow.
And then by the time we get to Fences, it might be 2 pages a day, you know, which feels like nothing. Yourself, yeah.
Get yourself back in the games.
Exactly.
So you were back on the set of a TV show set in a hospital.
Mm-hmm.
Were you tempted to end that episode?
Yeah, with the thing. Globe? I wasn't a part of that scene, so I wasn't there when they shot that. Norman Lloyd and those guys were, but yeah, that would have been something. It was all a Troy's dream.
That'd be amazing if you just walked into Grey's Anatomy.
And then you pull back from the little snowy thing and you see the little girl just sitting there shaking it. No, you pull back from the thing and you see the girl, but she's a grown woman and she's shaking it.
There you go. You need to go back and do another episode.
Right, that's right.
Brilliant. Denzel, it's been a pleasure.
Oh,
thank
cheers.
You so much.
Thank you.
Pleasure. Thank you.
My pleasure.
Okay, so that was Denzel Washington, and let's start the reviews section with Denzel Washington and Fences. Phil Cap.
Yeah, Fences is originally a play by August Wilson, the august American playwright. And Denzel himself has played this role on Broadway to great acclaim in 2010. And to this very magazine, Empire, he broke the news back in 2013 that he wanted to star in and direct a movie adaptation of the film, which is what we've got this week, obviously. And the story is set in the 50s and 60s, in which Denzel plays a waste collector, dustman, we'd call them, Troy Maxson, who lives with his wife, Rose, Viola Davis, and their young son, Javan Adipo, I believe it's pronounced. And it's basically the story of this kind of rather fiery man and his relationship with his family and his need to impart the tough lessons that he's learned in his life. He wanted to be a baseball player originally, and things didn't work out for him. So he carries a lot of inner fire, inner frustration. He's been stymied in his dreams, and he's teaching his son some pretty tough lessons in a way that, you know, it's a very Denzel-y part. He kind of has a furnace beneath the surface that sometimes blows like a geezer. I've totally mixed my geological metaphor. There are any geologists listening, apologies. Yeah, what did you think?
Yeah, I really liked it. I mean, we gave this 5 stars, which obviously means go and see it, get off your butts and go and see Fences right away. And it's been nominated for a number of Oscars. And Denzel himself may come out of left field and win Best Actor for this.
Is that baseball?
I don't know.
It was.
Was it?
Yeah.
And it, which kind of fits. There's a big baseball theme running all the way through this film. This is a wonderfully acted, beautifully written movie that doesn't quite escape its origins as a play. It is a series of long conversations between people in one location. There are attempts to open it out a little bit, but by and large, it's set in and around the backyard of Troy's house, where he is building a fence, both literal and metaphorical, of course. And this is a really interesting character, a really interesting performance. Troy is a man who is trying his best to be a good person, but there is something inside. Troy is someone who's trying his best to be a good person. He's trying his best to be a good husband. He's trying his best to be a good father and a good employee. But there's something inside, the rage that he feels at having been passed over in what was then, especially, even more so than now, a white man's world, being overlooked in terms of a baseball career that he feels he could have had. He could have had an amazing baseball career. and all those little rejections accelerate and accumulate and begin to fester and eat away at him, and he falls down. He has flaws. He makes mistakes. And you can see this in particular in relation to his son, by Rose, his wife, by Viola Davis. Corey is the name of the son. And Corey is on the verge of a potential sports scholarship. And the constant bickering and arguments between the two of them, as you can see that there is something in Troy that even though he wants the best for his son, there's something about Troy's ego which gets in the way of that. It's a very interesting character piece. It's really, really well written. I have never seen Fences, so I don't know how much of it has made the translation from stage to screen. Seems like a lot. Got a lot of meaty roles, people like McKelty Williamson, who you know from, you know, character actor from over the years, from the likes of Heat. Really, really good as Gabe, who is Troy's brother, who was injured severely in World War II and is now somewhat mentally diminished. Viola Davis, of course, the smart money is on her winning the Oscar for Best Supporting Actress. She's great in this role, and she initially doesn't get a lot to do, but really comes to the fore as the movie goes on. And it's just a very intense, very moving movie that definitely is worthy of your time.
Lovely stuff. 5 stars.
Lovely stuff indeed.
Great way to kick off.
A great way to kick off.
Yeah.
5 stars for Fences. Very, very good stuff.
Yeah. And another doozy this week. It comes from Mike Mills, filmmaker and REM bassist. Mike Mills, 20th Century Women. I don't know if people saw The Beginners, which was a lovely piece of work with Ewan McGregor and mm-hmm. Christopher Plummer doing things that we'd not seen from them before. That was kind of a tribute to his father. This one is more of a tribute, I think, to his mum, who is embodied by a character called Dorothea Annette Bening. It's set in the end of the 70s, mm-hmm. Which is obviously I guess the end of the sort of somewhere between the kind of Nixon and Ford and Reagan eras, and it has a specificity in place. She's just kind of a slightly hippie-ish vibe to her life, but she's a brilliant character and is a great showcase for Annette Bening. Speaking of the Oscars, it's a bit of a shame that she hasn't really attracted any of the awards buzz for this.
I'll be honest, I'm surprised.
Yeah.
I'm surprised. This movie's only been nominated once.
Yeah, it's been sort of omitted from Oscars, and then it's the kind of film that if it doesn't get Oscars buzz, it doesn't really get any attention.
But it's the same thing. It's the same thing we're talking about in terms of that Chris Pine, Ben Foster being overlooked. It feels like there's a shadowy cabal that gets together and goes, you know, I've talked about this in the podcast before, this movie qualifies but not that movie, and this person from that movie qualifies but not that person. And it feels a little bit like 20th Century Women and Mike Mills' screenplay got nominated, but it feels like their performances are great.
Yeah,
Greta Gerwig is fantastic.
Yeah, just to sort of round out the narrative. I mean, it's a story with great female characters, really weird, really three dimensional, fleshed out characters. That her son is kind of at the heart of the story. He's kind of coming of age. He's got a burning crush on Elle Fanning, who he wants to be his girlfriend, but she's still his girlfriend. As our review points out, there's a bit of a difference there, but perhaps not in his mind. And like you say, Greta Gerwig, who's recovering from cancer and is part of this kind of troika of cool women who are in his life. So, you know, he doesn't really have that father figure, but he has really strong female role models. And it's just a lovely sort of character piece. We've given it 4 stars. And if we can do our bit by giving it a bit of a sort of push, because I think it's been unfortunate in the awards ceremony not to get a bit more attention. Even if it didn't get nominations, I just don't think it was in the conversation enough. And yeah. Annette Bening, who's been obviously an important figure in sort of, I guess, the indie cinema in America for a long time, hasn't really been prominent in recent years. So it's nice to see her get a great role. She was in that Al Pacino movie, Danny Collins, not too long ago.
I think it's by choice. No, not.
Yeah, I think she's got other things going on, quite clearly, but it's nice to see her getting her chops in getting into something meaty.
Yeah. It's a very funny film. It's a very warm film. Film that has a lot of wisdom and wit to it. There's a singer along every 5 minutes or so.
There's also, it's got a great soundtrack for people, I guess, listeners of a certain age. It will be right in the sweet spot. Lots of Talking Heads and Susie and the Banshees and Devo and stuff like that. So, and the music plays into it quite importantly.
Yeah.
Yeah, 4 stars.
4 stars indeed for 20th Century Women. And should we talk about Lego Batman?
The Lego Batman?
Yeah, let's talk about the Lego Batman, shall
Lego
we?
Lego Batman.
The Lego Batman.
Yeah, Will Arnett.
Will Arnett.
Will Arnett.
Obviously, this is the spin-off from the Lego movie, which came out a few years ago and had Batman in it, voiced by Will Arnett. And he was very, very funny. And everyone said that guy is great. Possibly the greatest iteration of Batman on the big screen yet. He gets the swaggering nature of it. He's really funny. He's got a great voice. Let's give that guy his own movie. That's what they said. And we were hopeful that this would be a comedy masterpiece. And it is very, very funny. And I realise that I'm setting it up with a massive butt coming. But I really like this film. I didn't love this film. I wanted to love it. I was hoping that it would be absolutely amazing. And the first half hour is really funny. Well, probably one of the, it's going to be one of the funniest comedies of the year, I think, when the dust has settled on 2017, literally and figuratively. And it's you know, it just hits you with joke after joke after joke after joke. It has an amazing action sequence at the beginning, which the Joker and all his villainous compadres get together and try and take Batman down, but obviously they can't. And then the movie begins to focus in on the emotional life of this Lego Batman. He's very much alone. He very much wants to be alone. Obviously, there's something missing at the heart of this character. The attempt to imbue this character with an emotional depth didn't quite work for me. The thing about Lego Batman is that he's enormous fun in small doses, pun intended, and didn't quite entirely charm me over 90 minutes. He's a bit tough to spend 90 minutes with. But the level of invention, once again, on display in a Lego movie, in terms of the comedy, in terms of the set pieces, is astonishing. Will Arnett is very, very funny, and he is funny throughout. I just think that sometimes there are elements of this character that can grate and that can wear a little bit thin. Others around him are also very, very good. Michael Cera as Robin, Ralph Fiennes as Alfred, very, very good. Doesn't get as much to do as I was hoping. Rosario Dawson as Barbara Gordon, who fans of the comic will know goes on to become someone else. Zach Galifianakis is very, very good indeed as a Joker. There's a whole ton of cameos.
Is his Joker better than Jared Leto's?
Yes. But yes.
Do you think he sent Lego condoms to Will Arnett?
Yeah, Lego rats.
Do you think this film has the potential to make more money than Justice League this year?
Oh, that's a cool,
I think the question, Lego movie didn't make a billion. I thought I checked it and I thought it had made a billion, but it made about 800 million.
Uh-huh.
Just wonder, given this is Batman, whether this could make more money.
See, I just think Justice League is going to make a billion, just a default setting. I just have that feeling. It just feels like it's going to...
But Batman Superman didn't make a billion, though, did it?
It didn't make a billion, but this is more people.
But I don't
know
if there's...
I'm feeling that it might do that. And if it is a better film, which we're all hoping for, then it's got a good shot. I hadn't even thought of that.
It would be really interesting if this makes more money than the live-action Batman. Because you've never had two Batmen competing with each other. Like, obviously, it's the same studio, but you've never had two simultaneous actors playing Batman at the same time.
Does this miss Lord and Miller?
I think it does. I mean, they are obviously still involved. But no, I just feel it tapers off a little bit. But it never stops being fun. But I was laughing uproariously for the first 30 minutes. There's so many great references to Batman movies past and to other pop culture touchstones as well. And then I think for about the last half hour, I was just smiling a lot. And the jokes do stop a little bit and the humour does wear a little bit thin. Four writers credited. Lord and Miller are obviously off doing their other thing, but they were obviously still involved in this. But would it have been better with them as directors? It's very hard to say, but yeah, you're probably barking up the right bat tree with that one. But having said that, it is still a lot of fun. And honestly, the Lego movie grew on me over time. So there's every chance a Lego Batman movie will as well. 4 stars for the Lego Batman movie. We don't have a lot of time left in the podcast this week, sadly, so I will give honourable mentions in the Also Al column to Billy Lynn's Long Halftime Walk, Ang Lee's latest movie, which has a very eclectic cast, Brit newcomer Joe Alwyn, Steve Martin, Vin Diesel, Kristen Stewart, Garrett Hedlund. Yeah, you know all those people in a movie about an Iraq war hero who is on a propaganda tour of the US with his company for 2 weeks. And it culminates in a halftime show at a Super Bowl-like experience. And the main thing about this movie, Phil, is kind of interesting because people aren't going to get to see this movie, I think, in the form in which Ang Lee intended, which is he shot the movie at 120 frames per second. Now, of course, as we know, most movies are shot and projected at 24 frames per second. Sean the Goddard quote, cinema is truth at 24 frames per second. There's a lot more truth in this movie if you're taking it literally. It's the
most truthful movie ever.
It really is. Have you seen it at 120 FPS?
Not in 3D.
Not in 3D. I haven't seen it in 3D. I've seen
it. No, but certainly high frame rate. And yeah. It's too much truth.
It makes your eyeballs sort of pop out.
I think Ang Lee professed his desire to fuck the frame.
What?
No, that wasn't Ang Lee. That wasn't Ang Lee. But yeah, it's a bit, it's ugly. It's not, I just, yeah.
Yeah, it's a very strange film. And if you can get beyond the visual. But this is the thing. Not many people are going to see it at 120 FPS because this was a big attempt in the States to try and, you know, to progress the medium a little bit, and it was roundly rejected. And I think there were only two or three cinemas in the States.
It didn't even really come out in the States.
Didn't really come out.
I feel like the studio didn't really believe in it. Yeah. So it just got
scrapped. You'll see a film, a big budget movie with big movie stars in it that looks essentially like it was shot in a camcorder, which is really strange. But there you go. And the film itself doesn't really hang together. It's a bit tonally all over the shop. So 3 stars for Billy Lynn's long halftime walk. Still some good stuff to recommend it, though. Vin Diesel's performance. Vin Diesel. Anything with Vin Diesel. What a man. Nick does not look
convinced. I want to see Xander Cage's long...
long
water
finish
motorbike.
Finish that sentence. Okay.
Long halftime water motorbike ride. I need to see The Return of Xander Cage. I'm going to go see it straight after this.
No, you're not.
No, I'm not. I'm going to work.
Also out this week is Alice Lowe's Prevenge, which she writes, stars, and directs.
And has a baby.
And
she
has
was
a
actually
baby.
Pregnant.
Yeah, she was actually pregnant when she filmed this movie. It's about a pregnant woman who goes on a murderous rampage. And it's dark and gory and blackly comedic and features great performances from a host of British actors, including the likes of Kyvan Novak and Dan Renton Skinner. And you really, really good people. Joe Hartley's in it as well. And it has definite shades of Sightseers. It's like Sightseers' weird cousin. So 3 stars for Prevenge. And a film we have not seen at the time of going to pod is 50 Shades Darker, the sequel to 50 Shades of Grey.
I hear it's darker than the first one.
I hear it's filthier.
Ooh.
Oh yeah. I'm clearing my schedule as soon as I figure out.
Chris, that's not a schedule.
Oh my word. Enough of that nonsense. So that's coming out soon. Check the Empire website for what we're going to give that. Could be anything.
Erotic.
Could be anything. From
special me. Erotic stars.
Special, yeah. 69 stars. No, come on, Phil. You
sorry.
Can't.
Oh. Sorry.
You ruin everything. And that's it for this week's Empire Podcast in association with mustard.co.uk, the insurance comparison site that helps you save time, money, and effort. Join us next week for more film-related fun. We will be live at the Prince Charles Cinema in London.
Yay.
Oh, yeah. For the 250th edition of this podcast, we have, I am reliably informed, sold out of tickets for that. However, keep your eyes peeled on the Empire Twitter feed and also the Prince Charles Cinema Twitter feed, which is at the PCC London, because people might not show up. There might be returns. People might not be able to make it. So, you know, there might be some sort of ticket swap thing going on if you do fancy coming along and watching us idiots giggling for 2 hours. We'll be joined by, well, wouldn't that be telling? I don't know who's coming. Phil, are you coming?
Yeah, I'll be there.
Nick, are you coming?
If I can find the time.
That's all we need. Until that glorious time, it is goodbye from Phil.
Goodbye.
It's goodbye from Nick.
Goodbye.
And it's goodbye from me. I'm off to be violently ill somewhere. Hopefully not over Denzel Washington.
Uh-oh.
See you next week. Bye.